조선민주주의인민공화국 정부 성명. 주체조선의 첫 수소탄 시험 완전 성공.
Fat boy.
In North Korea, thousands have recently gathered to celebrate Struggle Against American Imperialism Month. Well, what a better time to talk with Wendy E. Simmons, author of My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest Worst Place on Earth. I'm Suzanne Lang, and it is a novel idea on KRCB. Wendy E. Simmons is a traveler and a photographer, and her wanderlust has taken her all over the world, and she has widely shown her stunning photographs of the people and places she has visited. Wildlife in Namibia, Bumi tribal life in Ethiopia, a colorful Hindu temple juxtaposed with a drab apartment building in Sri Lanka. But her experience in North Korea, or NOKO, as she came to call it, was so strange and challenging that she had to write a book about it. Like Alice in Wonderland, her encounters in North Korea defied her own perception of reality, of the reality of human nature and culture. With humanity and humor, Wendy has brought us her memoir, My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest Worst Place on Earth. Here is our conversation. Wendy E. Simmons, welcome to Sonoma County.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
You're here with your lovely book, My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest and Worst Place, or I should say the funniest slash worst place on earth. And we're going to talk about the funny and the worst and all the beautiful and interesting photographs in the book and your journey to North Korea. But you are a traveler.
Yes.
You might have a career, but it seems like your career is to support your true identity as a traveler and a solo traveler. You've done lots of solo traveling.
I have.
And so tell us a little bit about how that came to you and how you've manifested that in your life.
Well, you're correct. It's absolutely my passion. I love traveling. I'm never happier. I never feel more alive than when I'm someplace new, wandering around. And, you know, I get asked the question a lot, and I partially think it's in your DNA, that wanderlust. I think you're born with it to some extent, and then I believe outside forces nurture it. And I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., so I grew up surrounded by diplomats and folks from the World Bank and, you know, reading the Washington Post. And I was always intrigued by people from other countries and other languages. And, you know, from a very young age, my mom encouraged my love of travel and allowed me to go away to Mexico when I was very young, around 12, to stay with a diplomatic family. And again, when I was in high school, to go to a summer in Spain, and I took junior year of college in Japan. And it just was something that was so important to me and always has been. And I can't really explain why, but when I'm not traveling, I don't feel like my whole self. You know, it's an energy infusion that I really crave and need.
And you have taken a lot of photographs.
Yes.
Quite stunning photographs of places and of people
mm-hmm.
in the locations you have traveled. And I don't know, I looked at your list of countries, and is it in the 70? I mean,
somewhere in there,
70, something like that, all over the place.
Yeah,
but how
yeah.
did you get into the fine photography that you get to share with people?
Well, I fall into a lot of things by accident, much like this book. And, you know, I was traveling and I just, you know, I would see things and I would want to capture them. And, you know, I love to share my adventures. And I just started taking photographs. It was never intentional. And one day I was showing them to people, and people started saying, "These are pretty good. You should keep doing this." But it was never my intention to be a photographer. It was never my intention, frankly, to be a writer or to write this book. It's just that I love observing and I pay close attention to things, and it's a compulsion. It really is. And, you know, it's a way to connect with people when you're traveling as well. It's always a conversation starter when you have a camera, and it's a way to be more intimate with the people when you're meeting them. And it's amazing to me how generous people are especially when you're alone, when you pull your camera out and you ask if you can take their photo, the whole dynamic changes between you and the person that you're photographing. It's really quite extraordinary.
So even in these days of selfies and our constant chronicling mm-hmm. of our own lives and of everything we do, it still can have that magic.
It really can. It really, really can. And, you know, I guess it has something to do with the person taking the picture and the person who you're taking the photo of. And, you know, I sneak a lot of photos, I'm not going to lie, but I also spend a lot of time talking to the people I take pictures of. And, I might take a picture and then talk to the person for a while and take a photo again. And the photo that I take after I've spoken to them for a while or while I'm talking to them, it's such a different photograph than, you know, a selfie or the standard tourist shot or something. It's because you're forming a relationship with this person. You know, there's a lot of cultures that think you're stealing a little bit of their soul when you take a photograph. And I believe that if it's a good photo, because they are really giving you something special when you take their picture.
And that does come through in some of the photos of yours that I've seen.
Thanks.
So, aside from the ones in the book, and you mentioned you're a solo traveler a lot of the time,
mm-hmm.
and that is something that many people are just terrified at the notion of traveling to a country where they don't know the language or the culture or the climate or anything, and being on their own.
Right.
So can you tell us a little bit about the joys and challenges of being a solo traveler?
Sure. For me, it's the only way to travel. I mean, I travel with other people, and for years I was very fortunate that my mom, my sister, and I would travel together in the summers, and I like that too. But, you know, I feel so badly that people think it's scary, and I think once you start doing it, it's less and less scary. So I really do encourage people to go. You know, when you travel with other people, your energy is focused on the person you're with. And when you travel by yourself, the energy is focused on the people that you meet and the sights that you're seeing, and it's all of your own energy. So you're not paying attention to making sure that someone else sees something, or what is your opinion of this? And, you know, when it's all about you and your opinion and how you're taking in your surroundings. And when you're by yourself, what's amazing is how many people are willing to talk to you and how many people are willing to bring you into their lives. And so the experiences you have as a solo traveler are just so vastly different than when you're with someone else. And the kinds of once-in-a-lifetime experiences that I've had truly would never have occurred had I been with someone else. You know, I joke sometimes that as a solo traveler, I barely get to eat meals by myself, because when you sit by yourself, invariably people come and invite you to sit with them. And, you know, if I'm walking on the street, people walk up to me all the time and talk to me. And it's almost very selfish to want to go alone, because I want to experience everything I want to do when I want to do it. I don't want to be tied to another person's emotions and energy and everything else. And, you know, as I said, the more you do it, the more you realize there's really no better way to see the world and meet its people than on your own.
I like that thought. Now, you decide you're going to take a trip to North Korea. How did that evolve? And that the timing of this trip, and I don't know, some of us might only know North Korea. Well, maybe it's the only way to know North Korea, as this kind of crazy place, and yeah. Team America and the interview which came out while you were there, I think.
The first morning, yeah.
But how did you decide, I think I'm going to go there and I'm going to go by myself, not part of an organized tour?
Well, I really do try to go everywhere by myself. So it was without question that I wanted to go there alone. And, you know, like the decision I make to go anywhere, it was random. I have no methodology. Something will just pop in my head and I'll decide to go. And I really crave unique experiences. And this certainly delivered. And as silly as it's going to sound, I had heard a couple of people talking about North Korea within maybe, you know, a week or so time. And I got this very silly notion in my head that it was on the precipice of becoming normal. So I thought, I've got to get there quickly before it does. So the idea popped in my head to go. And within a couple of weeks, I went. And, you know, I remember I spoke to the agency in China about going, and they were very discouraging initially of me going by myself. It's not done very often. And I understand more so why now, having been. And, you know, but I kept saying I really want to go by myself, and I wanted to go longer than most people because that's the way I travel. I like to spend enough time in each place that I really get a feeling for it. And it was that simple. I just got the idea and I went.
It seems like this trip turned out to be challenging in ways maybe you didn't anticipate.
Oh, I didn't anticipate it at all. I could never have imagined. You know, I go on lots of trips that are physically demanding. You know, the conditions are sparse, or, you know, I've seen tons of poverty. I've seen everything. And this was emotionally very difficult for me. I've never been on a trip where I cried, you know, all the time. And, you know, I'm a pretty strong individual. And you know, you have to, I guess like a doctor, you have to develop a certain amount of immunity to the conditions that you see around the world. And, you know, it was a combination of the poverty and, but more than anything, it was just the lack of free will that people have there. It's so shocking, and it's something you hear about and read about, perhaps, but you can't fully appreciate how awful it is until you're there. And it was confusing. It was depressing. The people I was with, my handlers, I just felt so sad for. It's just, you're so full of conflicting emotions. And at the same time, for me at least, I was aggravated and annoyed. I couldn't get any answers to anything. So I was just awash with conflicting emotions. And I hadn't anticipated how difficult it would be to be there for so long in those circumstances.
You share that with us very candidly in the mm-hmm. book. And I'll remind our listeners that the book is My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest Worst Place on Earth. And I'm speaking with Wendy E. Simmons, the author, and the book is filled with a lot of photographs that Wendy took on the trip. It's a congratulations. It's a really nicely done book.
Thank you so much.
You really do pull us into your emotional state and the way you related with your handlers. And you actually, and why don't we talk about your handlers?
Sure.
And tell our listeners who they are and your relationship to them while you were there, and maybe some of the context of what mm-hmm. traveling in North Korea is like these days.
Sure. So you, when you go to North Korea, you are not ever alone. You are assigned government minders. I call them handlers because that's basically what they do. And whether you are alone, as I was, or with a group of, you know, 20, 50, 100 people, you are assigned two handlers and you have a driver. And you are not ever without them unless you are in your hotel room alone at night. That's it. I wasn't allowed outside of my hotel without them. I wasn't allowed to go to the bathroom when I was outside of my hotel without them. I was with them from the moment they picked me up at the airport until the moment they deposited me back. And because I was by myself and there for 10 days, you know, I developed a relationship with these two women. And, you know, they are, unlike the majority of North Koreans, they're the elite 10%. And obviously they are, you know, really at the top of the food chain because they're allowed to interact with foreigners. And as a result, you know, their bubble is burst. They have, you know, they're the most, the smallest group of people who have any idea that there's anything going on outside of North Korea that's different than the rhetoric that they've been told their entire lives. So they're in a very difficult position. I liken it in the book to the prisoners in Alcatraz that could hear the, you know, normal life back in San Francisco back in the day. Everyone else in North Korea has zero access to the internet, no outside information whatsoever, 100% propaganda. So whether or not they have some inkling that something's going on, they have no way to verify that. Whereas my handlers are interacting with Westerners on a regular basis. So they are hearing from me that life outside is a million times better than what they've been told and the life that they're leading. So as a result, I think they were trying to navigate this very delicate balance of needing to ensure that I believed that it was the greatest place on earth, convincing themselves that it's the greatest place on earth, and yet somewhat envious and upset by the fact that I was telling them differently. And older handler in particular, you know, she really had a struggle because she was once a businesswoman purportedly and now is a, you know, not. And I think I represented for her a lot of things that she wished she had. You know, she it was a life that she wanted, while at the same time trying to convince herself that my life was terrible. I was an American imperialist. Her life was great. Her great leader was wonderful. My leader was the devil. So she had a real personal conflict that I think was harder and harder for her to hide as the days and days wore on.
And they probably were used to dealing with tourists maybe for a couple days, 3 days.
Precisely.
But 10 days, they got to see you at your best and worst.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's no downtime. You are with these women, as I said, from, you know, 7:38 in the morning until 8 at night. And they, you know, they drag you 10 places a day. And they're not allowed to just sit idly by. They are constantly talking at you. Constantly. It's a cult. So they're not allowed to just sit there and twiddle their thumbs. They have to constantly be telling you the history of North Korea. Every place you go, they're explaining to you what the great leader did when he got there and how wonderful he is. And so it's a marathon. And so they were exhausted. They had to have been as tired as I was, if not more so, because they're on all the time. And they're probably battling their own doubt while they're doing this. So, you know, if they were with a bigger group, they're not getting as deep with everybody. And so it was an entirely different experience, I think, for them as well.
And it sounds like you did not always respond with a smile and a thank you. Like in Lonely Planet, they cover North Korea, mm-hmm. but they do suggest just kind of being polite about things. And it sounds like you may not have always followed those Lonely Planet instructions.
I tried, and I really, everywhere I go in the world, I really do try to be respectful of the culture. And I think largely I succeed, but it was so hard in North Korea. I was so frustrated because they're so blatantly dishonest. You know, they answer questions in a completely inane or illogical way. They will outright ignore you if they don't like the question you're asking. They lie. And, you know, there's an example in the book where we stood outside one day in the rain and my older handler said, "It's a nice sunny day." You know, this is just not very easy to let go. Maybe more so in the beginning, but by day 8, you know, you're like, "You got to be kidding me. It's pouring." And you know, I went there like I go to any country to foster communication and understanding, and you're denied all chance of that. And so, you know, I kept saying to them, "I don't understand why you have us here if there's no discourse. What's the point of tourism? What's the point of you and I even being together if we're not here to learn about one another?" And, you know, the point is they want money from tourism dollars, not to necessarily learn anything about each other's culture. No one asked me any questions. You know, fresh handler would sort of sneak them here and there when we go to the bathroom. But, by and large, not one person asked me anything.
So you had your two handlers, mm-hmm. who in the book you call older handler and fresh handler,
right.
And then there was the driver.
Driver, yeah. He was character, too. It was quite a crew. I liked driver a lot. He and I had – we got on very well. He was he didn't speak any English, but he was a very nice man, and – you know, he and I managed to joke around, even though we couldn't understand one another. Largely, we had to speak to one another through older handler, which was tough because I don't think she necessarily translated everything I was saying most of the time, and less so as the week went on. But he was a good guy, and I felt really sad. And, you know, as much as a relationship that we, you know, I use that in quotes, that he and I sort of developed during the time I was there, it was very sad at the end. You know, he didn't even say goodbye. He just gave me my bag, and that was that. And that sort of sums up the whole problem. You know, they you can't form relationships where they're not allowed. You're an American imperialist, and that's the end of it. And, you know, with Fresh Handler, I think she and I more so did. And maybe if it was completely different circumstances, she's someone I could actually be friends with. And that was especially sad to me. But older handler, you know, driver, it's just it's not in the cards. They're not allowed. They're battling what they've been taught their whole lives about their impressions of you. And it's just an entirely different experience. And that's where I think so much of my confusion and sadness came from. I'm not used to going places and not coming away with new friends, or at least a clear understanding of one another.
Well, maybe a degree of that happened, and you could only hope that it did.
That's, you know, I asked that question in the book. You know, at the end, was it all my imagination, those moments where I thought we were bonding, or were they scared of reprisal, and that's why the goodbyes weren't forthcoming? You know, was it that they weren't scared of reprisal from the government, but of their own letting the emotional floodgates open, you know, Pandora's box? You know, already I think just knowing what they do about the outside world has got to make their lives difficult, as I said. And feeling emotions or feeling sad when they say goodbye to tourists is going to just exacerbate that. So, yeah.
As you said, they took you to a lot of different places.
Yes.
And some of it sounded pretty darn weird. And, and you know, for a country that in the photographs, they have a lot of buildings mm-hmm. and big things and big statues.
Yeah.
But the opportunity to actually see real people doing real things seemed like it was being almost kept from you.
They do their best to present the propaganda tour and nothing more. And you know, if you saw something normal, it was by accident. It was a mistake. And, you know, they'll take you to the hospital, for example, and it supposedly is the normal hospital. But, you don't see any patients. All the patients just went home. You just missed all the patients. Or, you know, they took me to a factory. And when we arrived at the factory, it had unexpectedly lost power 5 minutes earlier. And all 4,998 people had just left. And two had remained behind to make the biscuits. You know, it was this kind of craziness. So they would take you to real places, only there was nothing real about it. There was never anyone anywhere we would go. For example, we went to the Fun Fair, which is their extraordinarily depressing amusement park. And when we arrived, you know, there wasn't a soul in the amusement park. And within 5 minutes of arriving, a crowd of like 1,000 people showed up, and they were all adults and military professionals. And, you know, supposedly this is a spontaneous occurrence. They just all happened to arrive right then. So, but, you know, just walking down the street and seeing normal people hanging out on sidewalks or doing normal things that you would see in a city does not occur. It just does not occur. And if by chance you saw kids hanging out or something, it was almost like the Truman Show. It was a mistake, you know, and they would quickly scramble to fix that mistake. Anything else was staged, largely.
I imagine in a country where so much of the message is controlled, that didn't even dawn on them that you would think anything was weird about suddenly a flash mob, and it was the same one that appeared there or whatever.
Well, that was the crazy thing. I kept thinking, how dumb do they think I am? You know, and I would just think, am I crazy? Like, would a country go to this much trouble to do this for me? How much effort did this take? So that was another one of the conundrums, you know, that sort of internal conflict of, am I an egomaniac thinking that they would go to this much trouble for me, or are they this off the wall that they would? And there's a story I tell, for example, about the football game that they took me to. It was a Monday morning at 9 a.m. football game. On the Sunday before, at about 5 in the afternoon, they learned that the event that I had scheduled for 9 a.m. the next day had been unexpectedly canceled. And it was one of the choices, and I chose it. And there was a flurry of phone calls to make this happen. And my handler turned to me and said, "You're so lucky. There just happens to be a football game tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., which seemed very odd time for a football game. And when I arrived, There was no one in the stadium, maybe 40 people. And we're talking like a regular sized stadium. And my handler said, I'm so sorry, there won't be very many people here because it's 9 a.m. on a Monday. And then halfway through the game, you know, a giant crowd of people arrived. And all I could think about was, well, they must have had to make a lot of phone calls to get these people to show up for the game they staged for me. But on the other hand, you know, would a country really go to all that effort to make me believe that they have football games that normal people come to? It just seems so preposterous. But you can't put anything past a country whose sole mission it is to convince the people who live there and anyone who comes that it's the most fabulous place on earth and that the great leader's a genius. You know, this is the sole mission of the propaganda tour. So in that vein, why wouldn't they?
And we think of the, did you call him the great leader? The
yep.
great leader and the great leaders, which as we look at these people, mm-hmm. Well, there is a scary quality, I suppose, to anybody who theoretically has access to nuclear weapons.
Yes.
But at the same time, I think we've all kind of looked at these characters as really kind of ridiculous. They are ridiculous people who kill people
right.
and have slave labor going on in their country.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and then Kim Jong-un. Moon, who is the current great leader.
Right, the grandson.
And that they are almost looked at as deities there.
They are literally looked at as deities. At least the grandfather, Kim Il-sung, is. They abolished religion when Kim Il-sung came to power. And he's called the eternal leader. So the people believe, I mean, to what extent, I don't know. I can't get in people's head. But what you're explained is that he and his son, Kim Jong-il, are looked at as still running the country, even though they're dead. And the tall tales, all religions have some aspect of tall tales, depending on what you believe and don't believe. But, you know, they'll tell you that they were writing in, you know, full sentences, writing novels like Dostoevsky at age two, and that they make the sun rise and the stars appear in the sky and the most extraordinary stories. And that not only is he the leader of the country from his deathbed in the mausoleum, but also literally God and literally the sun, as in the thing that shines in the sky. And, you know, so they're revered in a way that is difficult for people who live in a democracy such as ours to understand. So it would be sort of as if you were absolutely in love and enamored of the president and believed he should have all the power in the world and also believed he was God and Jesus Christ and every other thing that you might possibly believe in. So it's very cult-like in that regard. And, you know, again, you have to try to imagine living in a world where you have no access to outside information whatsoever. So you are told these things from the day you understand Korean. You know, that's all you're taught in school. That's all that's on television. That's all that's on the radio. That's what your parents tell you. And you're under the threat of death if you don't believe these things. So it's very much like a cult in that regard. And therefore, it's not that the people are dumb or crazy. It's that that's the only information they hear. They live in a bubble, truly, truly in a bubble. And it's difficult to disabuse somebody of something that's all they've ever known their entire lives. And everyone around them believes it as well. So, yeah, they're very reverent. And the interesting thing, though, when I was there is Kim Jong-un, the new leader, he was really not important when I was there. So all the pins that the people wear were of the father and the grandfather. All of the photographs of the two leaders, which are everywhere. They're in every single room, every single house. All the statues, which, again, are absolutely everywhere. None of them were of the grandson, who's the current leader. And when I'd ask about him, no one cared to talk about him. It was very strange how unimportant he was. And I, you know, my opinion is that's what the Congress was. The 36th Congress was to officially confer power on him. And I imagine now the pins will change and they'll erect some statues of him and some other things. But it's really, you know, the first leader and the second one, the father and the grandfather, were just everything to these people.
I'm Suzanne Lang, and I'm talking with Wendy E. Simmons, and her book is My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest Worst Place on Earth. And this is A Novel Idea.
on KRCB Radio 91. Before we get back to my conversation with Wendy on her trip to North Korea, let's listen to Hannah Ganson's take.
Each day is like a kick in the shin. You lost your keys and then you lost your job. You got it back, but then you lost it again. Well, don't give up. All you need is a little time. Do something to get away. A place to go and no one will know you. Pack your bags, we're leaving today. North Korea, the place to be. If you never wanna be seen again, North Korea, such a treat, hanging with your new best friend Kim. You see, North Korea is the place to be, because the average life expectancy is 63. Let's go to North Korea, have a boba tea on me. You'll feel great and lose weight, 'cause everyone is starving, plus you're gonna feel really tall. And you don't need pepper spray in North Korea, 'cause you got nuclear arsenal. You'll grow soybeans and you'll have sweet dreams, feeling safe because of their huge army. And the government controls your knowledge of the outside world, so essentially your life is just free.
Hannah Ganson's North Korea from her album, which is called Al the Bum. Hannah is an LA-based performer who writes and performs music and stand-up comedy all over the country. Wendy E. Simmons is a world traveler and has been since the age of 12. She was struck by the cult-like control North Korean government continues to have over its citizens. Here's the rest of our conversation.
The iconography, which is, as you said, everywhere, I found really interesting. Also, the what in the book you call, I think, cognitive dissonance, which I was seeing everywhere as well. But the children were walking around with these backpacks on that, like, had Mickey Mouse and Kitty.
Hello Kitty.
And I just thought, these are things that they don't have any idea. So it's almost like there's no signification to these things, which I just found so ironic in a way that there they are with Mickey Mouse backpacks on.
Yeah, it's just stuff that came, you know, that they were given to them to put their school books in. It has no relevance. But what's interesting is that I had encountered these two tourists from Canada who were only there for 2 days, and I met them at the DMZ, and they had conflated the Disney backpacks with an openness that North Korea had, and had said to me that they couldn't believe how open and great North Korea was. They were so surprised that they even had these Disney backpacks and Hello Kitty, and I thought, no, those are just from China. That doesn't mean anything. They're not teaching that in school. They're not watching that on television. So, yeah.
I found it kind of creepy
in
a way that here you have these children that, well, why don't you talk about that? You were exposed to children and went to some schools and heard some music, and they were curious about
some, you. Yeah, it depended on the age. You know, I talk about this a lot in the book, too. I really gravitate to children when I travel. I really think they're a true barometer of a country. And, you know, they haven't been taught yet to behave a certain way with tourists. And, you know, I spend a lot of time at schools and orphanages and that type of thing when I go anywhere. And so I was very excited to see the children in North Korea. And I had loaded up on orphanages and schools and children's palaces. And you know, the experiences in those places were just as weird as everywhere else. They are on message. They did not deviate from the script. So the Children's Palace, I called it an extracurricular jail. What this is, what was told to me was that any child in the country can go and study whatever they want. What in fact it is that the children of the elite go to these after-school programs. They're assigned whatever it is that they're going to do. So they're going to be a violin player or a calligrapher or an accordion player or whatever the case. And they practice that instrument or sport or whatever every single day for their entire childhood. And then they perform for party members and for tourists. And I imagine they must do well or there's, you know, some kind of repercussion. So when you arrive at the Children's Palace, they'll take you into a room and pretend as if these children are spontaneously busting out a tune. Well, in fact, it's, you know, very well rehearsed and they're child prodigies. Each one is more talented and amazing than the next. So it's depressing because you know that these children have no lives, that all they do is practice the accordion for 5 hours a day after school. On the other hand, there are the rich kids who get to do this instead of being emaciated and, you know, tilling the field. So it's, again, it's this conundrum and this mixed emotion. And I went to one high school and it was so difficult because it was planted and fake, but then they were answering real questions, so I couldn't really tell what was real and what wasn't real. And I was there with some school teachers from Britain who just happened to be there at the same time, and one was an English teacher. And it was very funny because they were supposedly teaching English that day. We just happened to come into a class, an English class, and the British school teacher couldn't teach the lesson on the board because it was incomprehensible. But, you know, it was definitely, they knew we were coming. There was cameras in the room and there was probably 15 different handlers and teachers and principals to make sure that nothing went wrong. But on the other hand, they're kids and, you know, when they were answering real questions, how they could prevent something from being said incorrectly, I don't know. So it seemed like a very unnecessary risk given how tightly they control everything. You know, I had real encounters with some small children who were not yet in the children's party, which are called young pioneers, and they were so excited to see me and gathered around me, and that was kind of a unique moment. My fresh handler was really excited by it. She had never seen kids behaving so kid-like. Older handler got mad and made me leave. And every now and then, you know, I would encounter a kid that would stop and stare at me. And that sounds like nothing to people, but in North Korea, that's huge. I mean, that's a giant risk for a child to stop and stare or smile or wave or walk over to me or let me take their picture. It was pretty miraculous, in fact.
Doesn't it make you wonder what their home life is like?
I can't even imagine. You know, I said this when I went to one of the orphanages. I got on the floor to play with the little kids, and none of them would even look at me, you know, or engage in any way. And I think that's pretty basic human behavior, to just at least look up. And that disturbed me a lot, wondering what their lives must be like, that they don't even have that natural reaction to look at a stranger that comes into their environment. You know, or the ability for these 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds not to be at all ruffled when a huge group of people come into the room and they're performing, or, you know, just the, even at the orphanage again, I think the kids were maybe 3 or 4 years old and they could break into song and dance, like a perfectly choreographed song and dance routine. So, you know, that's not normal.
And they don't know it. It really is remarkable,
yeah,
that many people can be controlled to that extent.
You can't get away with anything in the world anymore. I mean, it is across the internet in 4 minutes. And yet they managed to somehow control an entire country's worth of people. And if it weren't for the recent spate of tourism, it would still be in its entirety. You know, it's only because the country's broke that they have allowed tourism to take place. And it's, you know, it's the Pandora's box. And this is where, you know, I think that hopefully eventually things will change. But had it not been for this, it's mind-boggling. I don't understand in this day and age how they're pulling it off, quite frankly.
Yeah. Your cover photo of the book is of a wedding couple. It actually does express a lot of that dissonance where you have a real stuffed bird and then some stuffed animals
as
part of the wedding cake or something.
Yeah.
But talk about that experience. And this might have been the first, this experience in the book where you talk about getting the stink eye from people. And it's almost like the only real emotional connection was through somebody giving you a dirty look.
Let me say first, you know, I've been a lot of places where people don't particularly like Americans, but once they start to talk to you, it changes. They recognize you as a person, or they might not like your religion or whatever the case, but once you have a dialogue, that changes. This was the first place I've been where it does not change. You're an American imperialist, and it doesn't matter what happens. You remain American imperialist.
And they told you.
Oh, they said it to my face. Oh, and they told me to my face. Or they would say, we don't like your country. We don't like your leader. You're okay. But they didn't mean it. They were just trying to be cordial. And so I had been in North Korea a couple of days, and I was starting to catch on to the notion that nothing was going to be real and I was going to get nowhere fast. And older handler was trying to be accommodating. She knew by now I like to take photos. And she had asked me if I wanted to see a real North Korean wedding, and I thought, fantastic. So it happened, of course, to be a Thursday at 1 o'clock, the wedding, at the same restaurant we were, so I was a little dubious. We managed to stay later at the same restaurant, and when the bride and groom arrived, you know, the guests were all in their work clothes, and no one was dressed for a wedding, and the whole thing was so bizarre, but, you know, I was pushed up to the very front to the bridal table and allowed to take the photo, which is the one on the cover. And the bride saw me with my camera standing in front of her and gave me the worst stink eye I have ever had in the world. And I thought, holy cow, that's real. This woman does not want me here or taking her photo. And it started this list I kept in the book of things that might be real. It's a little more graphically described in the book. You know, and there were moments throughout the trip, many of them were people's emotions showing through. Either they were laughing or found something sarcastic, or, you know, my older handler screamed, damn it, when somebody missed a goal at the football game. And, you know, so that's an important point in the book, is that the North Korean people are different than the North Korean government. And, you know, in the same way that we'll categorize, you know, the Russians as this or the Iranians as that or the Syrians as this, and it's particularly relevant now with the refugee crisis and how we're so dismissive of entire cultures and countries. And, you know, these people were just plumbers and doctors and school teachers before all of this started. And we've lost our empathy for everyone. And it's so awful. And it's very similar in North Korea. You know, these are just people. They were just born in the worst place. And it's so difficult because, yes, the place is ridiculous. The country is insane. But these are just human beings that have their normal lives. You know, they fall in love. They are frustrated at work. They don't do well at school. Anything that you and I experience, they just happen to live there. And so that bride was sort of the first reminder that, you know, how would you feel if some stranger with the camera showed up at your wedding and was taking your picture like you were a zoo animal? So it was a moment that was both refreshing and a good reminder that, you know, they were human too.
And we are rapidly running out of time, and there's so much more to talk about. So I want to remind our listeners, I'm talking with Wendy E. Simmons, and her book is My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest Worst Place on Earth. You had a meltdown, and at which you said you don't usually get this emotional and that sort of thing. You had a meltdown. Why don't you talk a little bit about what kind of brought that on?
I was just so tired. You know, again, I was by myself. So all of the energy of my two handlers, my driver, and the local handlers that we would meet at each place all day long, every day, was focused on me. And it, you know, try to imagine probably 30 people a day spending all of their energy to lie to you. And you knowing it's all lies, and there's no room for discussion. You're constantly worrying about getting arrested, or you know, doing the wrong thing, or getting them in trouble. And I'm a very open person. I love to talk, and you know, I have questions. And people were just blatantly lying to me all the time. And you couldn't ask anything. You couldn't get answers to the simplest questions. I couldn't get answers to even things like, when do they change the guards? You know, what time does the store open? Where do you go grocery shopping? Like the most simple questions on the planet. I couldn't go to the bathroom by myself. I couldn't do anything. And I live alone. You know, it was very suffocating. And, you know, the food was terrible. I was hungry. I never wanted to drink water because I couldn't go to the bathroom with that poor fresh handler having to come with me. So I think, you know, by the time like the eighth or ninth day, I'd had it. I was homesick. I didn't want to be stuck there any longer. As I said at the top of this, I felt so sad for everybody. You know, I just was really coming to grips with what it meant to have zero free will. And I think, you know, in an abstract way, you think you understand that, but being there, it was just so in front of me. It was so evident. It was so hard to digest. And I was feeling so grateful for my life. And so, you know, it's the big esoteric issues in life. I couldn't understand why I was so lucky, why they were so unlucky. You know, it was bigger than just my trip. It was calling into question everything in my life and why we're here and what's the meaning of it all and how did they get stuck here. And, you know, these just grandiose notions that I had always sort of had were thrown into chaos, and I couldn't understand anything anymore. So, you know, even though ostensibly it was because I was just kind of tired and frustrated, it was more than that. It just, nothing made sense. When you're in that position in North Korea, nothing makes sense. You don't understand why the world ticks the way it does.
And the water just maybe wasn't hot enough.
Yeah, the water in the tub was really cold.
It sounds like sanitation wasn't so
oh,
hot.
Yeah. You know, there's no. There's bring your own toilet paper. That's my best advice if you go to North Korea.
And hand sanitizer.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I thought it was actually kind of sweet in the book when, getting back to that wedding, when you went to the bathroom and what you thought was the bride might have to come and drag her dress through this mess.
I couldn't believe it. I know I think of the silliest thing sometime, but the bathroom was disgusting. And I kept wondering, like, what about her dress? This poor woman. This is her wedding day. She's gonna go to the bathroom here. But then immediately I shifted to, it can't be a real wedding. They would never ever have to go to the bathroom here. Plus, it's on a Thursday. And then, you know, I started to cogitate on this, and I would make myself crazy. So, yeah.
When you left, you ran into some fellow tourists there, mm-hmm. and they seemed to have a different experience of their handlers, like maybe they were cool and hip or something like that. And I wondered what you thought about that, about would your experience have been completely different had you had the cool hip, or would it have really just been a variation of the same theme?
I think a variation of the same theme. Everyone who goes there has the same propaganda tour, more or less. And if anyone's been watching the news the past couple of weeks, the reporting, you know, they just kicked out three BBC reporters for calling the country stupid or something. They held one for 10 hours because they misconstrued something he said as an offense to the state. Anna Fields, in particular, I've been talking so much about her. She's been reporting daily from Pyongyang while she was there, and her reports read like my book. You know, there's no difference. Everyone goes there and goes on the propaganda tour. But there is one person in particular I spoke to on my last day or last 2 days, and he was a younger guy and handsome guy, and his handlers, I think, were in love with him. They were very young. And, you know, so I think that even though they followed the rules, and he came back from his 2 days and we had dinner the last night with our handlers, and he said that, you know, they were joking with him and cool, but he still thought the country was crazy and insane. And we had the exact same experience. His handlers just probably weren't as, you know, conflicted and crazy as my older handler was. So, everyone's going to have the same experience. They just might not have as extreme experience as I did based on the fact that I was there so many days. I was by myself, and I happened to have a particular handler that had her own you know, her own grievances.
Yeah. And I don't know, it left me with a real sadness for older Handler in particular.
You know, I loved Fresh Handler so much, and I feel particularly sorry for her because she's young. But older Handler, I had such a love-hate relationship with her, but she's the one that stuck with me the most when I left. And I think she was probably the impetus for this book more than anything else. I could not let her go. I just thought about her all the time. And we had such a vexed relationship the entire time, but I had such a soft spot in my heart. And I will tell you one really amazing thing. You know, I talk about this in the book, how she kept telling me, she told me that she wanted this coffee shop. She really wanted to open a coffee shop. And just the other day in the newspaper, I was reading, there was an article about the one percenters in Pyongyang, the Pyong Manhattanites or something they were calling them. And they were talking about one woman in Pyongyang who got to open a coffee shop. And I thought, oh my goodness, I hope that's older Handler. I mean, I really felt so much joy. Even now, you can see I'm so happy. I just, if that was older Handler, that would be the best ending to this story. So... yeah, I don't know. She probably hates me, but I really had an absolute fondness for her. So
it could be that you're an important person in her making some changes, too. I like to believe that, and maybe you do, too.
Me, too. Yeah. I think she and I, you know, we had a bond in a weird way. So, yeah.
I think the book is actually a wonderful expose that is done with a respect for the people who are caught in this situation, who maybe would love to know who Hello Kitty is and wear those backpacks because they're into it.
Yeah.
And that maybe your visit there on a very small way and the book in a very big way will help break some of that down.
I mean, I couldn't ask for more. So.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for coming to visit us.
Thank you. And thanks so much for having me on.
This is your first book. You've been blogging, but this is your first book, and keep traveling and keep telling us stories of your travels.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Change happens, a person at a time. We've been listening to my conversation with Wendy E. Simmons on her time in North Korea, and her memoir of that experience is My Holiday in North Korea, The Funniest Worst Place on Earth. The book is published by Rosetta Books and contains beautifully reproduced photographs that Wendy took while there. You can follow her online and see photographs from many of her world travels at her website, Wendy E. Simmons. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight, Mark Prell, and Wendy Nicholson. We opened the show with something from hip-hop and electronic music crew Moby Dictus, who have appeared on the popular Korean YouTube channel Cream Culture, and that was from one of their latest music videos, which speaks directly to Kim Jong-un. We'll go out with something from another South Korean boy group called Block B, and this is Zero for Conduct. Subscribe to our podcast at krcb.org. There's lots of other good stuff on the website. And download our app and listen to KRCB anywhere you are. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.
역시 와다리 가다리 난 사가지 바가지가 야라리 야라리야
오늘부로 품행생
와다리 가다리 난 사가지 바가지가 야라리 야라리야 손 들어만 세요 젊어서 노세요 알겠으면 세요 에요 에요
어렸을 땐 나쁘지만 여관이 대충 그런 간지 It's time for some action
Hey brother 닮아도 진짜 깔로 다 엎어 사고 파토 왜 싸는 우리 타일러 따라해봤자 싸그리 아리 원더스 두디 스투피 싸움이 진작에 좋은 척 꼭 게임은 끝이 났지
쟤는 진짜 멋이 뭔지 몰라 저기 형편없는 몸짓 좀 봐 스테이지에서 능력게 노는 게 다 Break it up, ready go
오늘부로 품행세 품행세
Everybody say it 멀쩡한 날이 없지 와다리 가다리 난 사가지 바가지가 갈라리 갈라리야
오늘부로
지바가지가 갈라리 갈라리야
Come on 일 환영해 사랑 촬영하는 사람아 No 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 This moment 행복해 손을 위로 Don't be acting like a loser
Don't be acting like a doom-bomb 지금은 굶들 Let's not for wounder
Lose that we love ya 품행세포
멀쩡한 날이 없지 와다리 가다리 난 사가지 바가지가 갈라리 갈라리야
오늘부로 품행세
와다리 가다리 난 사가지 바가지가 갈라리 갈라리야
조선민주주의인민공화국 정부 성명 주최 조선의 첫 수소탄 시험 완전 성공
Fat boy.